It's Monday, March 23rd. It's every day is simultaneously Sunday and Monday, it feels like now. So this is LA Podcast. I'm Scott Frazier. We have Hayes Davenport and Alyssa Walker. We are all in our separate houses, as will become the norm. Still feels a little bit weird for me, but we all are living with it. How are you guys?
I'm doing okay. I was thinking last week, should we have just it's only three of us. We could have stayed far apart. Could we have just done the record in one place? And then Scott, you got really sick.
Yeah.
And so it's like, oh, it's a good thing we didn't do
right.
that.
Exactly. Yeah. I had the exact dry cough thing that they tell you just feel anxious about it, but also we're literally never going to test you for it. So you just have to survive your hypochondria. I made it. I'm coming through to the other side now, fortunately. So
You had that experience where you actually talked to a doctor and they said, we are not going to test you?
I did. Yeah, I did. And it was interesting because I have friends also, Rachel Reyes, friend of the show, who was on and talked with us about Fair Work Week, which is even more relevant now than it was when we talked to her and Haley Potiker about it. The experience she had was even worse because she actually had a fever and was told, yeah, you probably have odds are you have the COVID-19 disease, but we can only treat you, or we can only test you if it would change the way that we would treat you, which of course then was backed up in several consecutive press conferences during the course of the week. For myself, I never had a fever. I talked to a very nice doctor who helped me at least feel somewhat better about everything.
Over video chat? Was it a video?
Just on the phone.
Or just on the phone?
Okay. Yeah, on Friday I spoke with him because I was having, in addition to this cough, I was just feeling really lightheaded and run down and just kind of crappy in a way that without the additional context of everything else going on, you probably would just be I'm sick, whatever, I'll survive, I'll live with it for a couple of days. But yeah, I spoke to this doctor and he said, well, since you don't have a fever, we can pretty much rule out the flu, the regular flu. So that means it's either a cold or it's the COVID-19, which normally has a fever, but not always. And he said, either way, we would just tell you to treat the symptoms, make sure you're pushing fluids, make sure you're sleeping a lot, etc. But unless it's a circumstance where you would have to be admitted to the hospital, then there's no tests available. So he was comforting. I felt better after the phone call that I had. He kind of told me what to look out for. He said, if you feel like you're too weak to stand up, if you feel like your breathing is becoming labored, those should be obvious signs that you need to get into a hospital. Otherwise, you should be able to manage it at home.
So I think something that we, I guess this is our LA story, is just illness and sickness across the board. I think that's something that probably everybody encountered this week was either someone you know was sick and tried to get tested, or for me, it was people who were very close to me who were confirmed cases. My boss, for example, was confirmed to have it. Of a distant family member of my, a third cousin of my husband's mom died from it. And then we have the situation my parents who live in a very small town in Colorado. My dad is one of the people who represents a compromised immunity because he's had some heart issues. And my mom started feeling really sick and is over, she's 64. She's unfortunately not 65, which is the cutoff apparently for when the state had decided
that
you could be tested.
So much better.
And she tried all week to get tested. And they, one person would tell her one thing, another person would tell her another thing. They have a drive-through testing center in Colorado. And meanwhile, there's somebody, a woman who is in her town on the all the local news and national news sites talking about how badly she got sick and she was, in the hospital and all this stuff. And so this whole town is now terrified. It's a very small town, but also a town that people travel to and there's tourists. So it's not a situation where they're just, sheltering in place as a town. It's a place where people over the last month until they shut down all the tourism magnets had tons of people visiting it that probably brought it to the town. And now they have a lot of cases. And I think she finally succeeded to get tested. It might not even show up because it's been so long that she's been trying to get tested that she, is on her way to feeling better. But this is just a perfect example of, it's not even like a place of, I think there's been a lot of news about New York City and places like Seattle, like these big cities or big urban areas. Mm-hmm. The rural parts of the country are just going to get slammed by this because they also don't have the hospital capacity that we have in our big cities or any real resources to expand them. So for me, it's been keeping an eye on what's going on here, but then trying to monitor what's going on with my poor parents.
Yeah.
Especially those vacation destinations, like you're saying, where people go through multiple airports and end up in places without that kind of medical care. I saw there are small towns in Idaho, like these ski communities. For some reason, skiing seems to be a big vector.
It was because a lot of skiers brought people who went to ski in the Alps in Italy and all those countries brought it back. That was what happened in parts of Colorado, too.
Wow. It would be so nice. I've been thinking all week for you, Scott, and for your mom, Alyssa, and for me and Geneva, who have both been sick. She is finally seems to be getting over it, to know whether or not we had immunity, which we never will, or if we do, we'll won't find out for months. I mean, maybe there will be a serology test or whatever it's called, but instead we just have to, it makes no difference in terms of how we behave, like how we interact with the world. We just have to assume that we still could get it and could still communicate it and just have to stay locked in our residences, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because we're dealing with a disease that is it's very similar to other infections that you might get, you know, like that was what the doctor said to me, you know, it's an upper respiratory infection. Mm-hmm. And there are common ones that happen obviously seasonally every single year. So it's hard to say when you get something, if you are mildly symptomatic or if you're asymptomatic, whether it is this COVID-19 disease or whether it's something else. And then, like you're saying, Hayes, that's going to project out into the next several months of how do we have on a massive scale societal responses to who should be acting with precaution at what times. The limited testing is going to be extremely impactful just because we don't know. We don't have that information.
And I think something, too, that helped me understand, because I've spent a lot of the last week being very angry at the city and the state for not acting faster. And a story came out towards the end of the week that really helped me to understand why the response wasn't quicker by Alexis Madrigal and Robinson Meyer at the Atlantic, who have been trying to correlate all the testing numbers from the states where the CDC really has failed to do that. They've been working on a project. You can follow it on Twitter, the COVID-19 tracking project. And their story was really about, like, you can blame anybody you want, but it really is just we could have headed this off if the testing had been ramped up from the beginning. And every single city and every single state have a pandemic plan. Like, they have worked on it. They've drilled it. They've talked about it. They even if with the failure of the federal government to act, we do have these local plans in place. But it was all contingent on testing and knowing the actual real numbers and the plans getting triggered at a certain point when you have a certain number of cases. And what's happened is because we don't know the number of cases, and now we never will because of the guidance that's being provided. Like you said, maybe down the line, maybe there'll be a faster test. There's been talks this week about a 1 hour test that can be processed the same way they process the flu test, something like that. Maybe that will happen. It probably won't be in place for a few more weeks for a lot of people to have access to it. But the reason that the response was so much slower at the local level is because they weren't ready to start to say all the things that we've heard this last week until they had those numbers, those positive cases or in many cases deaths. So what we have now is, again, as always a story with this particular administration, is cities and states trying to pick up the slack where we've been completely left behind or left, you know, basically abandoned by our federal government. And it's great to see that we can finally start, that we can rely on like our governor and our mayor to make these decisions. But it just feels so late. Like 2 weeks ago, you guys, they were running the marathon through Los Angeles. I mean, it just feels like this battle is already lost in many ways. Yeah. I don't mean to make anybody scared or exceptionally worried, but like you said, the right way to operate is that we all have it and we all could give it to somebody else right now.
Well, I mean, I think that's actually the fact that 2 weeks ago we were still running the marathon and everyone was still kind of interacting with each other as normal. A lot of those like cases that were acquired then are gradually being kind of processed through the system. And we so far, I think, have taken action faster than a lot of cities, a lot of other places in the country. and have been very lucky in terms of that the disease has not spread as widely here. Again, like we can just talk about the numbers we have, and this is all qualified by the fact that we don't know really how many tests have been done. It's in the few thousands, but we have no idea. There's so many people like Scott, like Rachel, like so many others who want tests but can't get them. So this is clearly not the number of cases, but it does give you just a general figure for the number of people, like the proportion of cases that are being registered for who's getting tested. So today, as we're recording this Sunday, they announced the largest increase in cases, in new cases so far, 71 new cases and one additional death, which brings the total to 5. I believe the last three they announced were all, they said, people over 65 with underlying health conditions. And then I'm just going to go backwards from today. So yesterday, Saturday, it was 59. Day before that, 61, 40, 46, 50, 25, 16, 11, 8, 6. So only a few days ago, really only about 10 days ago, there were only 6 new cases per day. But what that shows is you had that kind of fast growth in the beginning. We went from 25 to 50 cases in one day. But since it got to 50, it has kind of not plateaued, because we did have a pretty large increase today to 71. But the fact that there were a few days when there were fewer new cases than the day before is a really good sign that because of the restrictive measures that the city has taken, because people are self-quarantining, the cases are not blasting off here like they are in New York. Like we might see happen in places like Florida soon, like they did in Washington for a long time. But yeah, Scott, you were looking at the numbers in LA and around California compared to other parts of the country.
Yeah. And I just wanted to say, too, the way to think about, I think you're absolutely right about talking about the fact that what we have in terms of confirmed cases, the Department of Public Health for the county and really every official has been saying, we know that this is underreporting what actually exists as far as the population of people who have this disease, just because of the limitations of getting testing to individuals who might have been exposed to the disease. But when we're talking about something like a pandemic like this that spreads through a population, if unchecked, it spreads in an exponential manner, right? So if we look at actually like the rate of change, even though today we had the most confirmed cases that we have had in one day so far, actually for the past about a week, for the past like 5 or so days, we've had a pretty steady increase of like 20% relative to the previous day's total each day, which on that track is like doubling every 5 or so days. That is considerably different than what we're seeing in other places. Like you mentioned, New York, obviously the Lombardy region and Italy, where the current epicenter of this crisis is. But in America, we're talking about New York City, where just in the span of one day, I can't recall if it was the city or the state, it might be statewide, that the number of deaths actually doubled from one day to the next.
Mm-hmm. So like Massachusetts, I think Massachusetts added something like 130 new cases just yesterday, just in the past day. And in all of Massachusetts, there's only about 6 million people. And LA County, I mean, when you're talking about like numbers in the 50 to 75 range, that's in the biggest county in the United States. 10 million people live here. So comparatively, obviously, you'd like to see it start to really level off and decline, but compared to other places, these numbers are pretty good.
And something else to note, the LA Times set up a really beautiful site where you can track the daily numbers. The public health department just puts out a press release basically with some data, but the LA Times has made it really quite easy to understand. And they also have a map now of where the cases are being reported. And again, we don't know if this is because they have better access to testing or because, you know, we don't really know why, but there is definitely like a huge increase of positive cases on the west side. I'm just looking at the numbers right now. Brentwood, West Hollywood, Melrose, Hollywood, you know, these areas And the mayor of West Hollywood also has been confirmed positive. So just looking at, I mean, again, like we don't know what these numbers actually reflect. It might just mean that these people are some of the, say, Lakers players that could get, that have tested positive. You know, we don't know how people are getting access to these tests, and we don't know what these numbers actually mean. But I think it's maybe more things will start to become more clear, or they won't, because people are just not going to be tested at the way that they should be.
Yeah. Let's talk about the LA Times for a second, since you brought it up. I've seen a lot of people online complaining that the LA Times has not made all of its coronavirus coverage free, put it all outside the paywall. I've also seen a lot of reporters saying that you know, they some stuff is free, but they need to stay financially healthy. And I think it is important to recognize, if you look at the LA Times' digital subscription numbers, they are very low. They are well below what they were hoping to achieve. Like, under this new ownership, they're not really on pace. And so I get it. They're also watching Gannett and all these other newspaper chains collapse all around the country. And so they are trying to ride out what's happening in the economy for months going forward. I mean, I get it. It's tough for people that can't afford a subscription. Like, they should have access to this information. I wish there were a way to get it to them. But I understand the frustration that these reporters are experiencing when people like Jenna Fischer from The Office and lots of other people with blue check marks who clearly can afford a subscription are asking them to make it free for them.
Yeah, I mean, just to say something about journalists right now, you think of journalists that are going out to report at being like, you know, war situations or after fires or mm-hmm. maybe earthquakes, where it's very easy to see that lives are endangered. Reporting actually means like going and talking to somebody, which yeah. is could be potentially deadly to you as a reporter. So like our work, for instance, has really discouraged us from doing any kind of field reporting. But there are people at the LA Times and other publications that need to take photos and actually talk to people and actually go places. And I think that if you're thinking about your local businesses that you're trying to support as part of your restaurants and bars that are closing down or maybe can't offer, you know, the full range of their services to you, I would highly consider your local news to be part of your weekly tip jar. And if there's any time to buy subscriptions or donate to any type of news media that you consume, now is definitely the time, because they are putting their lives on the line for you.
Mm-hmm. That's another thing. I mean, like, something that's really not sustainable, and I guess we'll use this as kind of a segue into the big city council meeting this week, but I've seen a GoFundMe for just about every private business that exist. Like, every restaurant has a GoFundMe for their staff, where we have to and should be worried about reporters and people in so many other industries. It just cannot be that we're just relying on the kindness of patrons and just like individuals to be like constantly giving money. I mean, like, and if you did donate to every single one that comes across your feed, yes. that's like, you know, like a few dollars per fund, and it's just like it can't add up to enough. So we need something else to come along to provide people with relief and resources to get through this crisis. And to that end, let's talk about the very, very long city council meeting. They're one a week now. Is that right?
Yep. Through the end of March, at least, and presumably for longer than that. Council President Nuri Martinez, representing District 6 in the Valley, she canceled all of the city council committee meetings and every meeting besides the weekly Tuesday meeting for the whole council as a body. Obviously, there is still a lot to be done in terms of figuring out the city's response to the pandemic. So they ended up with a, what was it, like 12-hour long city council meeting last Tuesday, presumably going to have something similar coming up this upcoming week. But yeah, so that they went into a lot of details about how especially renters are going to be treated in the coming weeks and months as the economic recession and the fallout from the pandemic become more clear. In particular, Mayor Eric Garcetti had a plan for what he felt like was an eviction moratorium that would help renters out. The city council took up their own version of that. And I believe that they're still waiting to like finalize the exact terms of it this Tuesday. Is that right?
That's probably what will happen, I think. Yeah, unless they can't with committee meetings, so they have to do everything in these long marathon sessions.
So yeah, so it was mostly
you watched and you rewatched today most of the debate around this, right, Scott? So this is fresh and
yeah, that's right. I watched in particular Michael Kohlhaas, who runs michaelkohlhaas.org, which does the California Public Records Act requests. Posted on YouTube a lengthy segment from this city council meeting where the whole body is discussing in public, for the public record, their stances on who should be included in this eviction moratorium, who should not. There are also representatives from the city's housing and community investment department and the city attorney's office there to advise on the legality of these actions. But the intention, as stated at the outset, was to determine basically under what terms should a renter be able to not pay the rent that is owed as part of their contract.
And when do they have to pay it back?
And when do they have to pay it back? So the initial mayoral statement was the payment should happen over a course of 6 months for anybody who is materially affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. The council took up initially a more generous package that would have stretched for 24 months. Would have allowed
that was proposed by Councilmember Mike Bonin.
Right.
And I believe it was also, it didn't require any proof of being affected in different ways by the coronavirus. If you needed to not pay rent that month, you just didn't have to pay and you would have 2 years to pay it back.
Yeah, requiring the Bonin package was intended to cover all evictions, like you're saying, and was requiring the landlords to establish a payment plan with the tenants for a period of up to 24 months once the crisis is ended, I believe, once the emergency declaration ends. Now,
so it wasn't 24 months from the non-payment. It's 24 months from the end of the emergency.
I believe so. I would have to double check.
When will that be?
Yeah, no, and we have no idea. So that was Bonin's proposal, originally seconded by Gil Cedillo of the 1st District, who eventually rescinded his second for that. But basically what happened at that point was the council members got up and took turns talking at length about the impacts that such a long repayment window would have on the so-called mom and pop landlords. This is like the small business owners of the landlord industry. It's impossible really to say, for reasons that we've talked about on this show, particularly in our episode and interview with Aaron Mendelson of KPCC. We talked about why it's so difficult to determine how many mom and pop landlords there actually are. Nonetheless, this is a presence that looms large in the minds of the council members. Some of them are indeed landlords, so maybe that explains some of it. But
Michael Kohlhaas reported this week that 7 out of the 15 council members are landlords, including, I'll come up with that complete list, but I know, including Paul Koretz, who talks constantly about how he is a renter, but he is simultaneously both a renter and a landlord. He rents but not in his own building. He rents in a different building. It's so fascinating.
So we had the comments that were made here were, I think, pretty telling in a way that we don't normally get this level of insight into what the council is thinking about anything. And one of the things that we've talked about on here is that we weren't sure whether or not Nuri Martinez as council president would have the kind of firm grip or discipline among her council members as the previous president, Herb Wesson, did. Obviously, these are extraordinary times, but the discussion that was had on the council floor here would be almost unthinkable, even like this time last year, basically. So we got John Lee first saying that he was unsure about the legality of interfering with the landlord-tenant relationship in this way.
For him to speak up first.
Yeah.
Not now.
Just the boldness required for someone who, as we'll talk about, could not be more adjacent to a shocking FBI investigation happening right now for him to say, like, oh, you know what? Let me just weigh in here before the rest of you.
Yeah, anyway. he was first at bat. He wanted to. Well, I mean, maybe it makes sense for him to get up and say that he doesn't know about the legality of a specific situation. Maybe that's exactly what he wants to say. So, yeah. So he got up and he said that he felt like the 24 months was too long. That was echoed by others, most notably by Paul Krikorian and Bob Blumenfield. Krikorian was saying that. He basically said anybody who enters into this 24-month period, the city would be allowing for them to go delinquent on this debt and that it would become uncollectible by the landlords. And a really, to me, one of the exchanges that will stick with me from this particular council meeting was Krikorian comparing the duty of the body to the Hippocratic oath, the first do no harm in the middle of a medical crisis, right?
Right.
He's
yeah,
saying
you're just
this.
Like, no.
And he is applying first do no harm to the city council's duty to landlords and saying that he, in his understanding, by having this 24-month grace period during which tenants could pay back their rent, the city would be shifting the losses of the upcoming economic recession or possibly depression from tenants onto landlords, and that would be sowing some kind of unacceptable havoc among the landlord class. And that was really his full justification for what his proposal was, which was to shorten the 24-month period down to a 6-month period. That was eventually the motion that carried the day. And even though Mike Bonin made, I felt, what were very, I think that these will be very prescient warnings that he made to the rest of, mm-hmm. of the city council. He called himself Chicken Little, and he said he hoped that he was blowing things out of proportion. But he said, by limiting the moratorium on evictions to only people who can't pay their rent, by limiting it to only people who can prove that their right. impacted income was due to the coronavirus pandemic, we are methodically increasing the population of people who are going to be living on our streets.
Right, because if you think about it, I mean, it could be for any it doesn't mean you lose your job. It shouldn't be based on last year's tax returns. It shouldn't be based on, which are now extended now to July 15th, our new filing deadline. But it can't, you have no idea the hardship that somebody might be enduring because of this. And it might be very hard to prove on paper what you've actually been going through. Same with the conversations at the federal level about like who gets money and why. And also another thing that happened since Tuesday, it feels like it's been 5 months, is at the federal level, of course, they're going to protect homeowners and property mm-hmm. owners. So there's been a lot of conversations about, you know, how long people don't have to pay mortgages or kind of protections for people. So the landlords will be okay. I'm pretty mm-hmm. sure the property owners will be taken care of at the federal level, and that will be worked out. And our prime goal here is to make sure we don't have even more people a month from now who are being turned out onto the streets which will still be a very dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm. A month from now or 6 months from now.
Or 6 months from now, yes.
If it's decided like, okay, you didn't pay your missing rent back in 6 months, now you can be evicted for non-payment of rent.
Right, it can't be like a 6-month thing either. Right, yes, of course.
And just to contextualize like what you're talking about with federal government intervention, so I think there's this idea out there that like, oh, they're going to come through with somewhere between $1,000 and $2,500 a month for people. That is not like set against cost of living. It seems to be a right. flat number that they're talking about based on your income. And LA has the highest cost of living proportionate to income in the United States, basically. And so if it ends up being $1,000, like that won't cover one rent payment for most people. So right. they'll already be behind. And with that 6-month grace period, you're having to pay back what you missed paying while paying your actual rent at the same right. time. Like most people just don't have that wiggle room in order to cover that cost. And so like while we may be with a 6-month grace period or payment plan like fending off a few more people falling into homelessness, we're just delaying
right.
it until this period is right. over. And you have people like Dennis Block, who is basically an eviction lawyer, runs a website called, I think, evictions123.com or something, saying like, we're coming, like we're like the eviction machine is not stopping. I think he had like some blog post saying like, in some cases it might not be the most appropriate thing to evict someone who is afflicted with coronavirus, but like in general they are going to continue to find ways. So what you do when you leave open other ways to evict somebody other than non-payment of rent, that those are loopholes that they know how to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
there are so many ways that you can get someone out of your apartment if you want to, for financial reasons, and they will take advantage of them now that they are left open. It's unbelievably dangerous. And just to tie this to one other thing that they talked about at that council meeting, which is they decided, so there's a law in the city books called 5611, which says that people who are homeless have to take their tents down during the day, and they can only carry up to 60 gallons worth of possessions with them. So whatever you can fit into basically a large garbage bag, like that's what you can take around with you, and the rest can be thrown away by Bureau of Sanitation. And the city council got together and they decided that the tents down law would go away. That was only intermittently enforced until about 6 months ago, when they really started enforcing it again around the time of that. 6 months ago, it was like 2 months ago, around the time of the homeless count. But they kept the 60-gallon rule. So people now who are falling into homelessness because they weren't sufficiently protected by the city, that's how much they can take with them of their possessions, whatever you can fit into a big garbage bag. And the rest of the city is allowed to throw away.
Yep. And which, again, I mean, when we're talking about the fact that the city is still pressing ahead with these kind of sweeps under these circumstances, I think that over the course of this weekend, the LA Times just reported multiple LAPD officers, what we're up to like four now, who have positively been identified as having contracted COVID-19. You're generating all these interactions that are, under the best case scenario, they are cruel. And we've talked at length about how bad they are for all parties involved. But now you layer on top of that the needless creation of these close contact situations where you're providing this disease of an easy vector to spread. It's just unbelievable that we are still doing this right now in the middle of this crisis.
And just to name names on that, that was a very rare split vote in the city council. Joe Buscaino, former LAPD officer, was the one who proposed keeping the 60-gallon rule in place. And 11 members of the council voted in favor of that. Only four voted no. They were Mike Bonin, Marquise Harris-Dawson, Gil Cedillo, and Herb Wesson. Everyone else voted to keep the 60-gallon rule. And meanwhile, you have the CDC saying today, I think, to cities, do not sweep encampments. And that's not what the city isn't talking about breaking up encampments. They're talking about throwing out people's stuff. But,
well, they're also talking about making people move their tents 6 feet apart. Did you see that too? Which was something that the county health recommended, which is, again, I think they understand if you give them information how to keep themselves safe, people probably understand and know that. But going out there and trying to mandate that, and like you said, like more interactions, more moving around. But again, we don't know if people are getting the information. We don't know if people who are we've heard from a lot of different people around the city that they don't actually know what the county and the city is mandating.
And even if they do, I mean, it's hard to imagine in some places like Alvarado and the 101, for example,
like,
those tents are right up against each other.
You put six
feet of separation between them. There's no way to fit the number of people that live under that overpass. But the reason the CDC said not to break up encampments is it causes people to disperse in the community, which but also makes it difficult for service providers to stay in touch with their clients.
Right.
Which is true under normal circumstances.
I was going to say, this all sounds like the exact reasons why homeless advocates have been saying don't do these sweeps forever.
Right.
It's like all of this, all of the stuff they're talking about. I mean, as someone who's worked on the NIFIA campaign, I can't tell you how frustrating it is to have David Rue, her opponent, now saying like, oh, it's time to freeze rent increases. Which NIFIA is like a... has been talking about how rent has been allowed to increase out of control way past inflation for over a decade. We should have been freezing rent increases long, long ago to allow renters to catch up to this like breakneck pace that rents have been going up. And to have that proposed now in this circumstance just shows like we just could have done so much of this all along, and it was mm-hmm. always the right thing yes. to do.
Well, and also now it's not enough either.
Of course.
Now it's not enough. Yeah. I mean, what Rue is doing is proposing it at a point in time when it would no longer be effective enough to say like you can't increase rent. What we're talking about now is something that Paul Krikorian, again, during this council meeting was saying. He didn't think that anybody on this board would advocate for rent forgiveness or, you know, like actually halting.
Why not?
Halting that. I mean, to me, I was like, oh, well, that's actually really insightful, Paul. Thank you. I appreciate you giving us that insight into your 14 colleagues that you don't think any of them would stand up right. for what millions of renters in LA currently need.
Well, and also what's being proposed in many other places, it's not like even a radical idea at this point. Like many other cities and even entire mm-hmm. states are proposing very, very, you know, progressive protections. And
progressive
also just,
states like Kansas.
Right, exactly. Yes. Like, yeah, states like Kansas. Yeah, that haven't even really, you know, seen the problems that we've seen yet as far as like a surge in, you know, our hospital shortages, hospital space shortages and all those things. And one other thing I wanted to mention is the utilities. We didn't really have, I don't know like what the final, again, if it was a city or a county type of mandate, but I checked in like DWP, all the companies basically just said, have tweeted or sent out like, if you get anything saying you'll be shut off, just ignore it. We're not shutting off anybody's water, power, gas, mm-hmm. anything like that. So don't worry about those type of things.
One thing to just mention before we move on to the next topic, I've seen a lot of people talking about this and getting some criticism for it, but it sure has been nice out outside. The air, it feels like I'm in like Glacier National Park or something. It's like so pure.
Yeah.
Like the city really just feels so much more habitable because so few people are driving around. And I have seen some people saying like, it should be like this all the time. I said, well, this is because of a horrible, tragic pandemic. This is not like a good thing, but how do we keep, so can we have both?
Yeah, I mean, you really don't want to. I mean, we're one of the major news items this week is like a lot of transit agencies are in trouble. Metro's cutting service back. They're probably one of the least jeopardized by a loss of ridership since ridership was already low relative to the operating costs here. But they're down something like 60% in terms of the number of passengers boarding. Mm-hmm. I've thought about this too in terms of like the last thing that you really want as somebody who wants to like. To make an impact in climate change and like reducing greenhouse gas emissions is to emerge for everybody to emerge to the, from this cocoon and then be like, that was what we want every day to be like, like this period that was so traumatizing for so many people. But I do agree. Like today was the first day that I had where I wasn't just like hacking, coughing with every breath. So when I went outside, I was like, wow, I'm just like taking these deep, full breaths. And it's the kind of thing that you normally experience when you leave LA for a couple of days and you're like, wow, I didn't realize how much I was used to the air being dirty until this moment. But I agree. How do we get that good air quality without forever associating it with a very traumatic event for so many people?
The two things that I reported on this week, which I thought were really interesting, were first of all, Metro, along with, you know, hundreds of other transit agencies are going to the federal government and saying, we need to be part of these, they're not technically bailout packages, but you know, get us back to work and keep us alive during this time. One of these essential services, which the federal government will never see transit as an essential service the way they see, say, airlines or even the cruise industry,
right.
You know, they're talking about. But meanwhile, if you walk out there, and I did the other day, I was like, okay, who's riding buses? Like everybody's like, oh, transit's down, but there are still people on the buses. We were mm-hmm. sitting in the park today, looking at the Gold Line going by, and there are people in every car. There are people who have to ride it, and there are people who need to ride it, and there are people who are still going to ride it, and there are people who work for Metro and LADOT and all these other services in the county, agencies in the county that still need to go to work, and they're an essential, you know, worker. Yeah. So we need to make sure that we're taking care of these people, making sure that their safety is prioritized. First of all, their health and safety is prioritized. A lot of The buses have, like, a lot of bus systems, like the Big Blue Bus, maybe Foothill Transit, a couple of these other smaller ones have changed to all-door boarding where you can walk in the back door just so you don't have to get super close to the driver. Some places have gone to no fare to make sure that people are just don't have to worry about it, making sure that especially healthcare workers or anyone else who's low-wage worker just doesn't have to worry about this at this moment in time. I think those are the right moves. And then we heard on Friday, Metro, like you said, reduce service a little bit, but not going all the way and saying we're making it free and not really making those other changes to say that we're protecting our workers by making sure that people can walk in the back door. And they do have those like plexiglass like partitions, I guess, in the front that might protect them in a way. But I'm still really worried about this because if we lose, if cities start to shut down transit or cities start to really limit it, there is no way for people to get around safely because what are you going to do? Ride bikes? I mean, all the scooters are gone now. Yeah. The micro mobility that we've had, they've all been pulled from the streets. Uber and Lyft, like, doesn't probably sound like a super good idea to share a car with someone else that has just been in it. And if you don't have a car, you're really stuck. You are really stuck at this period. So we need to start thinking about how we can create either some type of emergency system, transit system, or and then trying to look forward again just to figure out how we can make sure that these transit agencies have enough money to keep operating throughout this. And when people start to ride them again, have money to jump back in and increase ridership again.
There are some lessons here for the car-free future that this podcast has been advocating for, or limited car future. Just walking around, I mean, the streets are much more wide open, and that has led to the cars that I have seen are going very fast. It feels yes. I ran one errand in my car this week, and just going around, I was realizing, like, God, this feels more dangerous, way more dangerous.
Absolutely.
Like, every car is every street is like a runway, pretty much. And so all those street safety improvements that we've been talking about would have been so useful now. Like, God, I mean, I haven't been out on my bike yet, but I feel like it will be scary.
Yet there are a lot more people riding bikes. You know, it's been raining
I see so many
more people riding bikes. I see people, like, a lot more people walking every day. I mean, again, like, this is going to be our reality for a while. And what can we do to make sure to give these people not just a way to get around for essential needs, but also to let people get out of apartments and smaller homes to get out in the city and get some fresh air, because the parks are packed. And I have a hard time taking my kids places and telling them not to touch anyone. And whereas we're walking on a sidewalk where there's tons of people walking by us.
Let's talk about for a bit. There was a big federal trial this week. What day was that, Alyssa? That was early this week.
5 or 7 years ago. No, yeah. It was March 19th. So that was what, Thursday?
So the city was basically under quarantine at that point. But this freewheeling federal judge decided to hold this trial. A friend of the show, Ben Oreskes, was there. Alyssa, what was the trial about and what?
Right. Well, the timing was super interesting because we had our safer at home orders issued on Wednesday. Right. So that was the night before this trial began. And as part of, you know, we kind of knew the safer at home or lockdown or shelter in place, whatever you want to call it. We knew this was coming because it was something similar to what San Francisco was going under. And then later that night, the state, Gavin Newsom, kind of issued the same type of order for the entire state. There were I think 14 counties that had already done it by the time that LA County / city issued it on Wednesday night. So we knew this was coming. But then one big part of it, besides just saying, you know, everybody stay home, essential businesses only, was this other secondary announcement, which was that the city was going to house a bunch of unhoused people all of a sudden. It was going to take this dramatic, unprecedented action to not only open up some emergency shelters, and I think they announced 13 locations open by Sunday night. So already open by the time you're hearing this, with about 6,000 people by this just one effort of to get people into these temporary shelters. And then another phase, which we're still waiting to hear the details on, about hotels and motels, getting people who need to either be quarantined or need to just get into a safer living situation into hotels and motels. So this was announced Wednesday night. And then the next day was this federal trial where basically the county and the city had been ordered to house people through this court case. So I was, you know, the whole day just reading through Ben's Twitter feed, because he was one of the few journalist that was allowed to go. They'll talk about, again, like journalists risking their lives to cover these things. And he was also very concerned about the sanitary measures being taken at the actual, in the actual courtroom, with people not keeping away from each other and not having protective clothing on. But he was one of four reporters that was there and really got to do a play by play. I think they normally might not have let him live tweet, and they let him do it in the room, which was kind of amazing too. So we had people from the county, we had people from the city, we had our city attorney there, we had our police chief there, we had all these people there trying to make, I guess, make the argument that we are trying to do this, that we are, that we have not been negligent in trying to house our homeless population as of one day ago. And this judge, Judge Carter, who is kind of famous for being a real hard ass when it comes to homeless issues, and had also told other cities in the region that they have to just suck it up and house people by whatever means necessary. Mm-hmm. And he seems like a really like effective judge in that way, because he just is just like no nonsense ruling here. So it sounds like, I mean, I can't really tell like what the outcome is going to be in being complicated by our current new crisis. Because it seems like now what could have been a very effective order at telling the city who they had to house and when has now been like, you have to house as many people as possible to protect them from this pandemic, this global pandemic that is, you know, confronting you. So I'm unsure what happens now when you have this kind of ruling or even this kind of conversation at the federal, you know, level. Mm-hmm. I don't know what your guys' thoughts were about what came down.
I mean, what, like, just to talk about the effort to house people urgently, I think, like, my understanding is that that 6,000 number is aspirational for the entire program. With these, like, I've seen some of these rec center shelters is basically what they are. They've repurposed the Echo Park Community Center, the North Hollywood Rec Center, and about like 10 or a dozen others. And each one of them has about 25 or so beds, and they're cots, essentially. Like, they, you know, they, it feels like emergency relief, which is not necessarily a bad thing. It is something, it's not a bad thing. It's something that probably always should have been available. I mean, if it was really just about putting cots in a room, that feels like something we could have done. They are filling up slowly. I know some people don't feel necessarily safer in that environment from a virus than they do in a tent, an individual habitation. Right? But Echo Park is full, basically. Partially because today it's Sunday, it's supposed to rain tonight and on and off for the next 4 days. So it's great to get people out of the rain in this situation. But I am really looking forward to this next step, the motel and hotel policy, putting people in actual rooms. I'm enthusiastic about that. And that is actually the kind of action that a judge could be responsive to. Like, that is, that's housing.
Right. I mean, there was nothing necessarily, who knows, the judge might still say you have to do something. I don't know how these things work, and I don't know how the courts are going to function over the next few weeks or whatever, but he could say you have to put everyone in a hotel or a motel room, and we actually could do it at this moment in time.
Yep.
And not only that, we could help employ people who have been safely, I'm not saying that we should put people to work if there's not safety, but somebody will need to help clean and feed and provide food and services to people who are living in these places. We have a lot of volunteers who are just volunteers right now who are putting their lives against on the line to go to food banks and all these other situations to make sure people are taken care of. But we actually could make these essential workers to make sure that these people stay alive for the next few months. I mean, it seems like something we could do.
Mm-hmm. Should we talk about the other big story? I mean, this feels like, I mean, if we really want to turn back the clock, just go back to a simpler time and just pretend it's like late 2018 again. It would be so nice to be able to revive an old segment, and it gives me great pleasure to be able to say, Weezer! I don't have a good follow-up lyric for this. I was just trying to think of one as Alyssa was talking, I'll be honest. But I already used my wife as a fundraiser, and the fundraiser comes up so often in this new story. Maybe something with England. I'll figure it out. I'm sure there will be a next time. Scott, what happened in the Jose Weezer story this week? We got texts. We finally get to read texts.
Oh,
this is
God.
What I wanted all along.
There's definitely going to be more to come. I think so. So this week we have another filing. The LA Times picked this up. David Zonzer and Emily Alpert Reyes had it, or actually, and Laura Nelson had a story about it when the filing first dropped. There is a lobbyist, a real estate appraiser in the city of LA. His name is Justin Kim.
They call him a fundraiser, right?
They do call him a fundraiser. However, his actual job is he is a real estate appraiser and advisor and has actually held multiple panel commission type positions with both the city of Los Angeles and the county of Los Angeles. This guy, Justin Kim, he has pleaded guilty to bribery of an official, in this case, a city council member for the city of Los Angeles. We'll talk about why it's definitely Jose Huizar in a second. But so he is now the second named person that is the direct losing end, I should say, of this federal investigation into City Hall corruption. Justin Kim, according to this filing, it says that he disputes some of the factual elements of this story, but he, I guess, agrees with the whole of it, the totality of it, because he has pleaded guilty. Over a period from 2016 to 2017, he worked with this council member listed in this filing to secure a cash payment of $500,000 in order to get a council member to basically nuke an appeal, a CEQA appeal against a private development in the city of Los Angeles. So this council member, as I said, it is almost certain that it is Jose Huizar, who is known to be at the center of these investigations. And we can say that because, according to these allegations, this is somebody who, during the time period of the investigation, 2016 to about 2018, we have this individual serving on both the Planning and Land Use Management Committee and the Economic Development Committee. There are four individuals who meet both of those criteria. Those are Curran Price, also named in a previous search warrant, Gil Cedillo, and Marquise Harris-Dawson, as well as Jose Huizar. But
at the time, it would have been Mitch Englander, right?
Englander was not on economic development.
Oh, economic development. Okay, sorry, yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
So there are maybe like nine of them, but then you cut it down to four in the Venn diagram of both of those committees. But then a lot of this filing actually centers around the fact that this unnamed council member is very desperate to get cash in order to establish the political action committees, or as we call them here, the independent expenditure committees, for a relative who they had a succession plan in place for his relative to take over his seat at the end of his term. Now, Marquise Harris-Dawson just got elected to only his second term in office. He ran unopposed. So that happened just a month ago.
You're trying to make this like a harder,
I know, but it's fun. It's fun.
I wish they had made it more fun or more difficult in this case.
Curran Price, he's not up for re-election until 2022. He's got another term of eligibility. And the same is true of Gil Cedillo. Jose Huizar, on the other hand, he had a very well-known relative attempting to take his place. That was his wife, Rochelle.
Announced and filed
in September of 2018.
That's right.
About a month and a half, I think, before the raids on City Hall and on Jose Huizar's office and home, I should say. So, and then she withdrew promptly from the race at that point in time. So yes, so this is apparently I want to make it clear that not only does it point to Jose Huizar, it appears to uniquely point to him.
And I would say also the tone and enthusiasm of the text, Jose Huizar is known to be sort of a late night Twitter reply guy. And just like, I'm not picturing any of those other guys like texting with this degree of like fire, yeah. I guess.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what I mean. Like, yeah, this is more like cash in a paper bag.
Isn't it a liquor box?
Both.
It was a liquor box.
It's both. Yeah. Okay. So let's do the narrative.
We need like a map of like all the places cash was presented to.
The narrative of this filing is pretty excellent. I mean, this is really the story that keeps on giving and is floating me through this crisis, I should say. So the narrative is this. Justin Kim was a known lobbyist. He was somebody who was working with developers in the city and received an email in August of 2016 from a developer saying, we are the subject of our project that we're doing in Council District 14. It says in this council member's district. So downtown Los Angeles, most likely a developer, probably a big developer, is saying our project is the subject of a lawsuit, or not a lawsuit, an appeal, a CEQA appeal, the California Environmental Quality Act. And it's this particular labor organization that is holding up our project. We want you to see what you can do about getting us through this appeal process as cheap as possible. So Kim goes to Jose Huizar, allegedly, and says that, well, I mean, Kim is saying that this is what he did. So Kim goes to Huizar, and according to the filing, Jose Huizar and one of his staffers go to a separate lobbyist who is a close associate of this labor organization. And they ask him, how much would it cost to resolve this appeal? And they said, if you were, let's say, going to hire your own lobbyist to get this CEQA appeal solved, it would cost you $1.2 to $1.4 million. Jose Huizar, they have a couple of meetings, including at, like, they say, a karaoke spot in Koreatown. And so in a couple of meetings, the council member says that he will resolve this appeal for them, but he won't do it for free. He wants to be paid. So they take this $1.2 million number back to Kim and the developer, and they end up haggling him down to $500,000 cash.
So Huizar asks for $1.2 million, which is about what they would have to pay a lobbyist.
Yeah.
And so, but he says instead he'll take
Hey, if you want to do everything above board, here's what it'll cost you.
Got it.
And they say, what if we give you $500,000? And and that was apparently acceptable to him. The assumption was Jose Huizar would keep $300,000 of that and Kim would keep $200,000 of it for services rendered. We get into 2017 and Huizar has a series of conversations with the lobbyists. They're talking back and forth about what we don't actually know at this point. That's left out of the filing. But what they end up with is the lobbyist and the labor organization are happy. They say, okay, we agree to, Huizar is going to oppose the appeal anyway, so we'll drop it, whatever. Unclear whether or not they receive anything for that. But then we actually get the exchange of money where Kim hands Huizar's staffer $500,000 in a paper bag. Oh, sorry. It's at that point, it's $400,000 in a paper bag. And then the liquor box that you were talking about, Alyssa. So Huizar's at home and his staffer texts him and says, hey, are you up or whatever? Do you want to see this? Do you want to see this cash I have? So then he comes over with the $200,000. In a liquor box. Huizar's been saying this whole time, I need this money to float this campaign that I'm running, which I mean, just to say, Huizar doesn't get this money, but if he's talking about funding a campaign with it, then not only are we talking about bribery, but we're also talking about some form of money laundering, right? Like that is
clear. Yeah. And like the election crime,
right?
Of that you setting up, putting this right into an independent expenditure committee and finding someone else to be the face of it.
Yeah.
I mean, just the number of crime. I mean, we were talking about like what Mitch Englander was accused of, which was taking bribes to broker a meeting to arrange a deal.
Yep.
This, and well, actually what he was indicted for was the cover up, more or less. Mm-hmm. And it's unclear even, I mean, I'm not sure it was even illegal to take money and like get wine. You're supposed to report gifts, but in terms of like federal crime, it's not really a bribe to like get gifts in exchange for like brokering a meeting. It's like official votes and duties and stuff, like dropping a CEQA appeal,
right,
that gets you in real trouble. We are talking about jail. Like this is like really, really, I mean, and also for Englander apparently, but like this is an order of magnitude more serious.
I would agree.
The Huizar stuff.
I would agree. And so the remainder of the filing, this is a very interesting document to me because only about half of it actually deals with Kim and comes from information that Kim supplied or is relevant to. The other half of it is all about Jose Huizar trying to, A, set up this pack for his wife with this illicit bribe money, and B, trying to get the bribe money, which apparently
set up a meeting
becomes very difficult. There are like two full pages, just as you were saying, Hayes, dedicated to texts from Huizar to his staffer. No indication of a reply from the staffer, just sort of saying, hey, what happened to our October 1st meeting? You're supposed to give me the financing period for the campaign has already started. I can't get a hold of you anymore. It's a very like alpha dog sort of moment where Huizar's like, this guy is apparently has left the ranch and Jose can't get a hold of him anymore. So
it feels like Uncut Gems when when he has to drive to Philadelphia.
It's really great. And so it kind of ends on a cliffhanger.
Can I read one of the texts?
Yes, please.
Yeah, please.
The famous one that everyone was talking about is, sounds like every you in this case is the letter U. Sounds like you don't ever want to meet and face up to your commitment to meet. You want it all. And that's the real reason why you don't want to meet. I got it. I will make it my life's mission to figure out what time of day text was set. The replies for Jose Huizar, usually after 10 p.m. is when the replies used to start showing up on Twitter. I mean, and it's the phrase, it's all there. I love it.
It's so good. And honestly, so my thinking about this is we now have two of these filings in a very short period of time, which seems to indicate that we might get a lot more in the near future. I think a lot of these unnamed individuals.
Yeah, hopefully they come up with enough evidence to bring a case against Jose Huizar at some point.
You know, and it's interesting. People have been asking, like, why at this point has Huizar not been arrested still?
And not I think been arrested. Remains on the city council.
Still
and
voting.
I do want to point out, this is still voting. This is how you know he's really fucked. Is the council members are now starting to not talk about him by name necessarily, but to be like, I saw David Rue and Bob Blumenfeld. Were those the only ones?
Or were
the
only ones
this week saying like, now enough is enough. Like now this is too much.
Right.
I mean, that means it's serious. If any of them are speaking up in vague language about how like somebody did something wrong, that's huge.
Yeah, but if you kind of look at just like the chain of events, I think what you're saying about Englander versus Huizar is absolutely right. It is an order of magnitude different. Mm-hmm. Englander also, like you said, he was just charged with the cover up. Although they actually mention several potential federal crimes that he is guilty of, or that they believe he might be guilty of during the course of his indictment. So potentially we're seeing some kind of leniency in the charges there, or maybe they just didn't have enough evidence to make that stick. He also gets the benefit of not being perp walked. He got to surrender to authorities, which is just a detail that I've been thinking about over the course of the past couple weeks. And then you have all of what appear to be a lot of subordinate investigations. And I assume that there is some degree of consequence to the order in which these investigations get made public. Probably there is an amount of tying off those subordinate investigations that the FBI wants to make sure is done before bringing in Huizar, at which point a lot of indictments, again, or the indictment against him is going to make a lot of information public. But it doesn't seem like he is going to get out of this without a lot of jail time at this point. It seems like he is in for a very serious fall. And the inaction by the council, stripping his committees is relatively, like, that's the least that they could have done, right? And he's still sitting on this body every day, and he's still voting on things every day and collecting his salary. You know, it's going to be a real moment of reckoning, and it seems like it's going to come soon, honestly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the one gift we have, like you were saying, Scott, like it's like to see this kind of misconduct, which, by the way, like, this was not the only time that this kind of exchange played out in this office. It's like common knowledge that this is a practice that exists, not just in Weezer's office, but around the council. For it to finally be out in the open is a good thing. And it's nice that we get some entertainment in the form of all these court documents and things. So hopefully that will be something we have more to talk about next week, and that there's more of that than virus related tragedy.
I'll have another blog post up on our website.
Yeah. Scott put up a great post, a blistering post, calling on either recall election for John Lee or for him to resign. Can I just point something out? A harrowing possibility. So that we're almost done counting votes. The John Lee Lorraine Lundquist race is really, really close now. It is possible, unlikely, but possible, that there is a write-in candidate in that race who went to debates and like went around, spent a little money, I think, and went around campaigning. It is possible that a write-in candidate could get enough votes to bring both Lundquist and Lee under the 50% threshold, meaning that Lorraine Lundquist, who has been condemned by Satan to run for the seat for the rest of her life, would have to run for the second time in a general, fourth time over, if you're including primaries overall, but that could be...
It could happen.
But yeah, read Scott's post. Glad you're doing another one, Scott. Continue to read Alyssa's great reporting at Curbed. Brian Holmes is the producer of this show. We will be back next week on LA Podcast. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
LA Podcast gonna have